The following program is brought to you by Podcast One Sportsnet. Don't forget to download our new Podcast One app.
Quick break to tell you guys about NFL Game Pass, the only way that you can replay every game all season long. You can relive all the gutsy calls, crazy catches, wild comebacks, and breakout stars from every game every week. It's all the action, all the football you can handle, all in one place. So every game that we're talking about right now, you guys can rewatch it after the fact. I'm going to be going back, and you guys can too. Go check out Lamar Jackson in week one. Go check out Dak Prescott and what that Cowboys offense actually did. Go check out Kyler Murray and his NFL debut. That's my favorite thing about NFL Game Pass. You can go back and watch at any time. And if you haven't watched a condensed game yet, you have to try it out. It's every play from the game back to back to back, so you can replay an entire NFL game in the fraction of the time it normally takes. It's how I'm able to follow all the MVP candidates, all the breakout stars, and, of course, your waiver wire pickups all season long. To see all the action this season and stay on top of all the big storylines, you need NFL Game Pass. Best of all, you can kick off the 2019 NFL season with a 7-day free trial of NFL Game Pass. Just sign up now at NFL.com/ProFootballFocusNFL.
As you gear up for the biggest game in the NFL season, Podcast One is teaming up with the Underdog Network to be your one-stop shop for all things football. As the big game draws closer, Chris Horwedel is joined by the Dan Patrick Show Danettes for their NFL postseason analysis.
I don't disagree with you. This could be one of the ugliest games of football of all time, which the Jaguars were already a part of one of those against the Colts this year, so we'll see if they replicate that.
Check out the Underdog Network and the Dan Patrick Show every week on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Welcome into the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Palazzolo back here with Sam Monson. It's playoff time, Sam.
It is. Playoff time. Straight in.
Wild card round. We got four games to preview, so we'll give them all a little bit of love so we don't have to go rapid fire.
No rapid fire for this one. You think we can keep it tight enough to do four games in a podcast?
Can we keep it within an hour? I don't know. You're a little long-winded.
You don't exactly help the process.
We don't work well together when it comes to keeping
We spiral out of control.
Short.
But I think people like that sometimes.
Maybe they do.
At least I'm going to roll with that until, you know.
The YouTube people think we hate each other.
Well, you know, you catch us on the right day and maybe they have a point.
Maybe they do. All right, let's get into this weekend's action. Two games Saturday. We've got the Indianapolis Colts at the Houston Texans to kick off all of the playoff fun. That is the first game, right?
I don't even know what order they're in, actually.
You
sure.
Didn't look?
Yeah, let's go with
sure
that.
I'm pretty sure that is. That's what we're starting with. Colts and Texans. I haven't planned out my weekend yet in my how I'm watching these games. Third time they've played. So you were talking about this whole... I mean, you were talking about a team that's already won two. These teams have split. The road teams won both games. But the third matchup for the Texans and Colts this year, that always brings an interesting dynamic to the matchup.
Yeah, and they're also tied in terms of points over the two games. So they've each been three-point win.
And tied in points against.
Yeah, yes, exactly. So essentially they're even, dead even right now, having taken one game to overtime, the road team having won both the encounters, and points for and against, therefore, are entirely evenly split. And this is, I think, a fascinating game for two reasons. One, because the Colts are still riding this hot streak. Andrew Luck's been really good. The Colts generally have been really good over the back end of the season. They've overcome, you know, one of the worst deficits in NFL history to still make the postseason. And on the flip side of that, you've got the Houston Texans, who I have been expecting to be found out all the way through the season. Maybe this is where it happens.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe this is it. This is one of those tests of the quote-unquote momentum, right? You know, the Colts are supposed... I mean, both teams are kind of riding pretty good momentum down the stretch, if you believe in such things, playing well down the stretch. The Texans did lose to the Eagles a couple weeks ago, but I'm interested, of course, in the quarterback matchup when you talk about the future of the AFC. And I know Andrew Luck's in, what, year seven, but, you know, that's not... It's not like he's getting old or anything. He's got 10 more years of quarterback play, assuming he stays healthy again. So we're talking about Andrew Luck, a developing Deshaun Watson in the AFC South. We already know about Patrick Mahomes, Baker Mayfield. I think the AFC is going to have some really unbelievable playoff matches, playoff matchups over the next few years with these quarterbacks. So let's start with Luck and the way things have changed for him this year. New system. new scheme for the first time. And I'm going to go back again to what Zach Robinson likes to, the way he likes to just to describe Andrew Luck. He's so good at progression passing and kind of the complicated aspects of quarterbacking that his entire career, whether it was Bruce Arians, whether it was Rob Chudzinski, whoever's his offensive coordinator, gives him difficult things to do. It's deeper drops, it's survey the field, and he always held the ball a little bit longer. But that was okay because he made special plays down the field. This is the first time, though, Frank Reich trying to get the ball out of his hands. He had 331 throws that lasted less than 2.5 seconds, which is kind of like our cutoff. Or is it a quick pass? Is it a longer developing pass? That's by far the most of his career. And he saw the lowest pressure rate of his career by 9%. It's a whole new offense for the Colts this year.
Yeah, the entire Colts offense used to be essentially Andrew Luck can make it happen. You know,
right.
If we just let him play, give him a deep drop back, ask him to find a guy, he'll do it. And
right.
That's all we're going to rely on, which was fine, only it really exposed him to hits. It made life difficult for him because it was all on his shoulders. There was nobody that was sort of as fundamental to the functioning of an offense as Andrew Luck was to this Colts offense. And it ended up getting him broken, essentially, just subjected him to too many hits, too much punishment. By trying to eke out all the time he had and find a guy and take a hit at the end of it. This season, I think, has been big for his future because it's completely reversed that. They've tried to get the ball out of his hands quicker. They've tried to kind of help him out with the scheme as well as letting him do some of the complicated stuff. And it means he takes less hits now. So he's not subjected to the same level of abuse and physical toil that he was over the past few seasons. And that has to be good for extending his career long term and letting him play. And we've seen that, you know, if you're able to do all the complicated, difficult stuff like he has been, then of course you're going to be able to do the easy stuff as well. And, you know, when you actually focus the offense on giving him more of those, you get kind of the best version of Andrew Luck. He's still able to make some special plays every now and again, in particular where you see those kind of late fourth quarter comebacks. But he's also able to play at just a higher level down to down because you're giving him an easier job.
Yeah, he always had a high percentage of turnover-worthy plays, which was the complete opposite of what I expected coming out of Stanford. I thought you were going to see a Peyton Brady type of player who would be good in the quick game, five-step game, and then, yeah, he could make those special plays when needed. Instead, it was closer to a Brett Favre, high-volatile type of game that Luck played for years. So I do think he's settling back in as a more efficient quarterback. He still makes some bad decisions in there. He still had a high number of turnover-worthy plays, but not like what he did years ago. So I do think that's, you know, one of the keys. And then when you look at the offensive line, they don't get all of the credit for Andrew Luck facing 9% less pressure, but they do get some of it. It's definitely a hybrid effort. Anthony Costanzo, Quentin Nelson. So look, the two rookies, Quentin Nelson at left guard, he was the number 6 guard in the entire NFL. And then rookie right tackle Braden Smith, the number 27 offensive tackle in the NFL, which is good. There's 64
stars.
Yeah. And Anthony Costanzo. So those two rookies have been fantastic. Costanzo's the number 17 offensive tackle. So you have 3/5 of the offensive line in the top 32, so to speak. So they've improved quite a bit. They've been helped a little bit by the scheme and the quick passing game, but improvement across the board for the Colts has really made that offense tick. Eric Ebron's breakout season, of course, too. So a lot of good things happening for the Colts on the offensive side.
Yeah, and critically, Braden Smith played well when he faced Houston before. So he faced him twice, but he only played 4 snaps the first time because he wasn't a starter yet. When he played them the second time, he gave up a sack, so that's not good, but that was the only pressure he gave up in that entire game. So right. 1 sack and nothing else going up against that Houston defensive line is actually a really good return for a rookie in particular, right tackle. So,
yep.
You know, normally you would be heading into this game saying, well, okay, this guy's played pretty well, but he's going up against one of the best defensive fronts in the game. That's an area of weakness or a potential area to be exploited. But at least from what we've seen so far, he's up to it.
And, you know, it's still going to be a challenge with J.J. Watt,
right.
Jadeveon Clowney. I think I made the, I don't know if it was here, but I made the comp of JPP for Clowney in recent somewhere in recent weeks, maybe a touch better than JPP based off the grading, but JPP at his best was an elite run defender and a good, not great pass rusher. I think that's what Clowney has settled in as so far. I know he's battled injuries and all that stuff, but there's never been a time where you're like, oh, Clowney's a top 3 pass rusher.
Yeah.
But he's very good. And Watt has gotten back to that elite level. Well, he's at the elite level. He's not at J.J. Watt elite level, where he was unstoppable and he was in Aaron Donald territory early in his career, but we had him as first-team All-Pro because of his pass rushing, 75 pressures this year. So those guys as a tandem really give the Texans a chance.
Yeah, I think Clowney has developed into the best run-defending edge rusher in the NFL.
Calais Campbell's going to send you a DM on that
I think
one.
The other thing is he's kind of become this Michael Bennett-style player where actually where he's at his best is probably working inside where he uses that sort of physical freak ability and quickness to get in inside of tackles, inside of bigger, slower offensive linemen.
Right.
He doesn't really have the speed to kind of turn the edge the way, you know, truly elite speed rushers can at the NFL level. When you move those guys inside and they're still strong enough to get that done, you know, Michael Bennett with his little children's shoulder pads and his quickness has always exposed those guards and tackles inside. And again, it's not necessarily as a pass rusher. He's just able to shoot those gaps and destroy plays in the run game. And that's kind of what Clowney does, is he's still so strong inside. He's more than able to hold up against those guys. And his quickness, just the ability to shoot those gaps and come at them in a different speed that they're expecting, is how he's so devastating as a run defender working from inside. I think that's kind of where he's at his best. JPP, I think, is a good comp for the reasons he said. He's a better run defender than pass rusher. But I think Michael Bennett is another one as well in terms of kind of usage and how they make their best plays.
Yeah, and then the biggest story, I think, for the Texans on defense, when we came into the season, we said, look, the Texans, and we'll talk about their offense in a minute, they're weak in the wrong places because the secondary has massive question marks. Yeah, they've got, you know, if Watt gets back to it and Clowney's back to it and Merciless gets back to it, our preseason analysis was like, yeah, sure, they could have a good defensive line, but what about that secondary? They're getting an almost career year from Kareem Jackson. He's had a fascinating career. If you just look at PFF grades, there's a whole bunch of average in there, but there's one excellent season in 2014, a very good season in 2012, and now randomly a very good season in 2018.
Yeah.
For Kareem Jackson, who started the year at safety and has played more corner, allowed a pass rating of only 75 into his coverage, 10 pass breakups. So Kareem Jackson playing well, rookie Justin Reed playing well. He makes our all-rookie team as our flex defensive player. Jonathan Joseph, when he's been out there this year, has been pretty solid as well. So this secondary in back seven, Tyrann Mathieu, all these guys that have, you know, came in with question marks, they've been solid and essentially, you know, I think been one of the keys to the Texans' success.
I think both these defenses are playing at a level, they're outperforming the talent level, but for different reasons. I think the Texans are kind of scheming up a lot of relatively creative and exotic things on the back end. It's enabling these guys to have, to outperform the level you would expect from them. Like you said, there's a whole ton of guys that are either having career years or just playing extremely well. Mathieu, Kareem Jackson, Jonathan Joseph, you know, bit part players in the secondary as well. And then the linebackers, McKinney, Zach Cunningham, these guys have been playing well.
Cunningham's really come on the second half of the year for
right.
sure.
And then the Colts are doing almost the exact opposite. They're basically creating almost the most vanilla scheme you could possibly come up with on the basis that if you eliminate all the thought process and just say, right, this is what you're doing every single play, do it at 100 miles an hour, and more often than not, things will go well. Like, they've been doing that, and it's having the same kind of effect that these guys, you know, everybody knows about Darius Leonard, obviously, who's had a great rookie season, but they're still getting good play out of their defensive front. You know, the Margus Hunt thing that seemed like it could easily be a fluke last year. He's still been playing well. Like, he maybe hasn't been as good as he was a year ago, but Margus Hunt, Danico Autry, Jabal Sheard is still very good. You know, their front has been playing well. Leonard at linebacker, and then those group of defensive backs, Pierre Desir, has had a really good season for them. So I think you're seeing essentially the same thing, that two defenses that on paper have plenty of holes and plenty of questionable talent are dramatically outperforming that because of the coaching jobs, just in completely different styles.
Yeah, I'm trying to filter, but they've got the most cover two snaps of any team in the NFL, as the cover two is not really a thing anymore. It is funny, again, talking to Zach, who does watch every single snap. Actually, the Texans are right up there with the Colts in cover two snaps now as a percentage. He was talking about how teams were creatively getting to cover two, and I don't know if he was just talking about the Rams or not, but it is, there has been a big cat and mouse game with offenses and defenses, I think, in the second half of the season. But regardless, the Colts play a lot of cover two, cover three, a lot of zone heavy schemes where, you know, in today's NFL, when teams are trying to throw the ball short, you know, soft zones are generally conducive to that. But if you have the right playmakers, you can limit big plays, and you have a guy like Darius Leonard in the middle making a ton of big plays for them at linebacker. I mean, he's going to be a key for this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think both these teams have been fascinating to watch because of the fact that those schemes are actually having such an impact on the defense. What really intrigues me about this game is this idea of the Houston offense, though. It's Deshaun Watson and Nuke Hopkins and nothing else. That should not be good enough to win games and perform well consistently as an offense, and yet it has been all through the season. It's kind of amazing to watch, and it's hard to identify exactly why that's been so successful. Obviously, the two players in question are really good, so that's part of it.
Just so you know, so from a PFF grade standpoint, Nuke Hopkins, by far the highest grade on the Texans offense, 92.5. Deshaun Watson's number two at 82.6. Number three is Will Fuller, who is injured and only played 375 snaps. And then number four is Lamar Miller at 74.6. He's a running back. You know, who cares? Beyond that, everybody's in the 60s or lower.
Right. So you got...
And the offensive line is very low.
Two pretty elite guys. Everyone else in the 60s or worse.
Yes. And that includes Julian Davenport, the starting left tackle, at 52.9.
Yeah.
Martinez Rankin, who's, you know, played 430 snaps on the O-line at 42. And that's been the story. This O-line grades horribly. And Watson has faced the most pressure in the NFL, some of it on his own, but they've still managed to be productive on offense.
Right. It's kind of ridiculous. Obviously, the fact that those two are very good is part of the reason it's been successful. But even given that, it should be possible to slow down one connection when that's all you have, particularly when the offensive line is that bad. I think Deshaun Watson's ability to move around, scramble, evade pressure, etc., makes it harder still. Because, you know, you don't just have to deal with covering Nuke Hopkins. You have to deal with when things break down and, you know, the scramble drill starts and you have to adjust and all that kind of thing. Because Deshaun Watson can take off and make plays in the backfield and running, it's a lot more to deal with as a defense. So that's part of the issue. But this Nuke Hopkins season has been ridiculous.
Yeah, really
has. He has 159 targets this season, which actually isn't even close to his highest targeted seasons. Like, he's been up, I think, 200 at one point.
Yep.
115 receptions, so that's catching 72.3% of his targets. No drops. That's the highest total we've ever seen over a season with no drops whatsoever. And it's not like these are all routine catches. Like, despite the fact that he has no drops, we have multiple freaky one-handed catches in there. Like, these have been high-level difficulty catches that he's been bringing in, despite not dropping anything.
Yeah, it really has been an exceptional year. Highest grade we've given since 2006, tied for the highest grade, right? And then I'm looking at Watson's breakdown here. He has a bunch of games over 70-plus. Those are your solid grades. A few in the 50s and 60s, and two disastrous games in there. So he's an 82.6 overall. But, and I hate to do this if you take out two games, but just for the sake of argument, if you take out two games, he's a high 80s quarterback, which puts him in the top eight, top seven or eight, right? So if you're getting that level of play from Watson behind a bad offensive line and with only Nuke to throw to and a revolving door of other guys, first off, I think the future for the Texans looks really good if that's the case, because this offense has to get better talent-wise. But secondly, this is why I think it's going to be a great matchup. Watson can take over a game. Luck is our number three quarterback. He could take over a game. This is going to be a shootout.
Yeah, in theory. And it's also, it's interesting because with Colts defense, the thing that's making them successful is that they have been playing this relatively idiot-proof system that doesn't require thinking or adjustment or any of this kind of stuff. But given that the Texans are basically just Watson to Nuke, the game plan playing them should theoretically be to double Nuke every single play and force him to beat you with somebody else, anybody else, doesn't matter. Just take him away, right? It's not that hard to do. We've seen the Patriots, you know, dedicate themselves to stopping one specific player on an offense. It's very possible. Now, Nuke will make some plays anyway because he's that kind of freak, but you can dramatically limit the opportunities he has to make plays. But in order to do that, you have to go away from your vanilla cookie cutter system that just lets you line up and play. You actually have to change things around and insert some specific things that require thinking and communication and all that kind of stuff. So you would feel that the Colts probably don't want to do that. They just want to ride the horse that brought them there.
Probably.
Which is playing into the Texans' game plan.
Yeah,
because
we'll see if they...
all they have is Watson to Hopkins.
They'll still probably be forcing him the football. A couple other interesting Watson numbers, too. 60 scrambles. That's times he dropped back to pass and then took off to run.
Yep.
That ties Michael Vick for the most in the PFF era. So that's a huge part of the game. And all of the numbers, when he throws the ball outside the pocket, 5 touchdowns and a ton of yards. I mean, he's in the top 2 or 3 in the NFL. So he is one of those quarterbacks. And again, talking to Zach about what he was doing at Clemson, he was a lot of like one read and take off.
Yeah.
But this is one read, 2 reads, and then make a play. This is different.
Yeah.
And that has made him really, because when you give him one read to throw the ball, he's very good. But now his ability to extend plays, while he always had it in him, he didn't always show it at Clemson, and that's made him really dangerous.
But the other thing is his play under pressure has, or at least his play under pressure has been, I would say, unsustainably productive, only he's been sustaining it for a hell of a long time now. So
You know what is unsustainable? All right. So look, when you look at Watson from a 2-year perspective, his stats are exceptional. Last year, we were sitting there saying he hasn't played as well as the stats show. This year would still be the case. His PFF grade's lower than the stats would indicate. I think just the drop rate. He led the league in drop rate for the second straight year.
Yeah.
That is an uncontrollable thing. Of course, you've got Hopkins, right? Padding that.
0 drops from 170-odd targets, so I know, I said it was.
And I know people hate when we do this, but if you just give him a league average drop rate over the last 2 years, which is something he can't control, his passer rating probably drops 8 or 10 points. So he hasn't played as well as the stats have showed, but the under pressure numbers, yeah, 88.2 passer rating is also something that could come
out. So that's the number 2 passer rating in the NFL behind only Nick Foles, who obviously hasn't had long enough for that to come down. You know, that's, I think that one is a product of volatility and short sample sizes. Deshaun Watson at 88.2, despite being the number one pressured quarterback in the NFL.
Yeah.
Like, those things should not intersect. The guy that is pressured the most in the NFL should not have the highest passer rating when pressured. For example, the guy that's number 2 in terms of pressure is Josh Allen, and his passer rating when pressured is 47, which is like almost dead last.
That went up over the last couple of weeks.
Right. But the point is, the guys that are at the top of the pressured list should not have the highest passer rating.
Right.
So Josh Rosen is number 4. His passer rating is 38. Those guys should not be good at this, but Deshaun Watson seems to be consistently able to do it. I'm sure there's a degree to which this will come down to earth a little bit for no other reason than the PFF grade isn't as good. So again, when the grades and the numbers don't match up, typically the numbers will come back down to the grade at some point. So I would suspect his play under pressure comes back down to earth a little bit long term. But at least for the moment, he's able to do it at an incredibly high rate. And a little bit like Russell Wilson, he's kind of at home when he's playing this sandlot, ad-libbing, just make something happen game.
Right.
Like, a lot of quarterbacks, that would just be a death sentence to have there. Like, can you imagine Kirk Cousins having to play that way? He said, right, Kurt, drop back. No. There'll be a pressure pretty immediately. Run around, make something happen. Like, it would just be game over.
Oh, this
done.
But this is the danger. Do you really want to pressure, or do you want to play contain? And I think you have to mix that up, because he will take sacks too.
Right. But for Wilson and Watson, I think they're kind of at home playing that game and able to get really good results doing it.
Yeah. And the one final number I'll show, I tweeted out yesterday, the most sacks charged directly to the quarterback. It's Dak Prescott with 15. We'll talk about him in a minute. Deshaun Watson with 14. It's actually all playoff quarterbacks other than Josh Rosen. But so that's 14 times that Watson either left a clean pocket and got sacked, or he dropped back too far and his linemen were blocking for a different pocket and they lost leverage, or he stepped up into a sack. So that's kind of the risk-reward when you're coming after Deshaun Watson. You'll get some negative plays in there if you're looking for him, but he'll burn you, behind the coverage as well. So I think it's a fascinating matchup, even though we've already seen it twice. You know, Watson and Luck on the big stage. It's Watson's first playoff game. I just think we're in for a very fun NFL over the next few years with all these young quarterbacks. Where are you leaning on in this one?
I'm going to go with the Colts. I'm going to ride the hot hand, and I continually am waiting for the wheels to fall off this Texans bandwagon. So this is the chance.
I'm going with the Colts again, or as well. If for nothing else, I trust luck down the stretch. If this is a close game, as I anticipate it to be, I anticipate a shootout, and Luck has that knack for making things happen in the fourth quarter. Not that Watson doesn't, but Luck's got this history of making plays down the stretch. I think he pulls one out.
Plus, the road team's 2-0. I mean,
of course,
road team wins.
That trend,
obviously,
that trend matters a lot.
Yeah.
All right, so the next Saturday night game is Dallas and Seattle. Do you want to go chronologically, or do you want to stay in the AFC?
Chronologically, right?
All right, so it's the Dallas Cowboys hosting the Seattle Seahawks Saturday night, prime time. Got to put the Cowboys on in prime time.
Yeah, of course.
It's a rematch that I almost don't even remember. They played earlier in the year. It feels like ages ago.
Yeah.
Because early in the year, both teams were, Dallas looked like their season was going nowhere. Seattle was a team that didn't necessarily have their identity yet, and all these new players, and what are they going to do with this run heavy attack? So I don't even put much stock into the last matchup, but both of these teams playing pretty well, and Dallas's defense has been really good at home, and I think that's that matchup, Dallas's defense against Seattle's offense.
Yeah, I mean, Dallas period have been very good at home. They're 7-1 at home this season out of 10 wins. So that's the thing that the Seahawks have to overcome here, is the fact that this Dallas team has been pretty peerless at home. And Seattle, actually not as big a disparity as you would think for the Seahawks. They typically have the most dominant home field advantage in the league. They're 6-2, but they're 4-4 on the road. So they're a .500 team on the road, which isn't dramatically worse than their overall record anyway. So I think they can show up and take a game to Dallas. But the question is, like, is it enough? Because this Dallas team at home has just been so dominant, particularly that defense, which is, it's been the thing that's carried this team's charge, but it's got that thing that all really good defenses have, where they've got at least one really dominant player at every level.
Yeah, I like
so
that. Yeah.
Up front, you've got DeMarcus Lawrence repeating his season from a year ago. Not quite as dominant, but still, a primary pass rusher, an absolute ton of pressure. In the middle, they've got two of them. They've got Jalen Smith and rookie Leighton Van Der Esch. Those two have combined to be this incredible force. Dominant when it comes to flying to the football. Dominant at getting defensive stops. So they're not just getting to the ball. They're getting to the ball close to the line of scrimmage and stopping the offense for getting any kind of significant game. And then on the back end, you've got Byron Jones, who's this crazy story this year of a guy who wasn't even a cornerback a year ago. He was, drafted as this athletic freak safety type guy, the team projected to a safety. He became this sort of tight end eraser, jack of all trades.
Loved watching him cover tight ends.
This year, as they've pivoted to this kind of cover three, cover one system, they valued cornerback length and that kind of profile more on the outside. So they moved him back to cornerback, where he's been spectacular.
Yep. He has. And I love the Dallas defense and what they're able to do. And I think we remember the high-end games. They shut down the New Orleans Saints. They did it on primetime. Everybody is remembering that. So that's why you're looking at this game and you're like, all right, they've got a shot against Seattle. I think the interesting thing about this one with Seattle's offense is, despite having Russell Wilson, who's a consistent top 5, 6, 8 quarterback year in, year out, they went super run heavy this year. The highest percentage of runs on first down, highest percentage of runs on second down. In theory, it sounds like a terrible strategy. I'm not saying that it's been proven correct, but there are some games where it's worked for them. They had a Detroit game where they ran the ball something like 45 times and threw the ball 17 times. There is this perfect game flow where they run the ball a million times and only run, pass the ball off play action, and it works. It's a little risky because you're putting the ball into your running back's hands so much, but they're number 3 in the NFL. They're all their running backs yards after contact. The offensive line has improved. So they've gone run heavy despite having an elite quarterback who, when they're in a hole or whatever, you could bail them out. But even though they should probably put the ball in Wilson's hands more, it's worked so far this year.
It has. I just want to make one more point about Byron Jones, because Byron Jones has no interceptions this year. Which
he's still grading.
People will look at and say, well, how can he be a good cornerback then? Because interceptions are everything.
I noticed that yesterday when we put him on our all-pro team. And you like to just show all the good. He's got this many interceptions and pass breakups. It's nice to show, But the fact that he's grading that well without them.
Yeah. And the point is that his role within that defense is a ton of press man coverage, right? Which means he's up in the receiver's grill. He's turning away from the quarterback to match the receiver most of the time.
Right.
Those guys just don't get interceptions. They don't get a lot of them because they're not looking at the ball.
That's what made Darrell Revis so special.
Right. They're looking at the receiver. They're tracking the guy they're trying to cover. They're not really worrying about the ball until the last minute when it arrives, and then they're just trying to break it up more than they are pick it off. So the fact that he has zero interceptions is not a massive deal. He has 9 pass breakups, which is 4 more than anybody else in that secondary. His numbers have been pretty impressive, just a little bit over 50% in terms of completion percentage allowed. So don't be swayed by the fact that he doesn't have any interceptions, because the way he plays the game within that defense is not designed to generate those interceptions, and he shouldn't be punished for that, essentially.
What you described is what generally happens with man coverage corners. They allow a lower completion percentage. They don't pick off as many passes.
Right.
If you're a zone player, you give up more yards, you probably pick off more passes. So there's some boom or bust there. So Byron Jones, when Tyler Lockett's on the outside, Tyler Lockett having one of the most efficient statistical seasons we've ever seen for a receiver. A perfect passer rating when Russell Wilson targeted him this year, 158.3. And then the return of Doug Baldwin over the last few weeks. I mean, so that was my preseason analysis on this. Is you have a banged up Doug Baldwin, you've got Tyler Lockett and a bunch of no names at receiver, and you have an offensive coordinator who promises to run the ball down your throat. This looked like a formula for just disaster for the Seattle offense, but Wilson's played really well outside of a couple games and really a couple throws, and Tyler Lockett stepped up and been exceptional. And then, you know, you've got David Moore, you know, making big plays. Did I just forget his first name?
No, David Moore, right?
Oh, my God. I screwed up for a second.
It's okay. Let me just check here.
You look for it.
Let me check we're both right.
But Moore's made a bunch of plays down the field. And then Doug Baldwin comes back, and he's great.
It's David Moore. You nailed it.
My fault. But he was making Moore stepped up, made a ton of big plays down the field this year. And then with Baldwin back, you move him. He's in the slot quite a bit. Now they've got some tough matchups with these little receivers.
Yeah, I mean, Mike Renner, right, that made the point that the Seahawks offense, the way they've approached receiver, I think is the template for the future, right?
Yep.
There was a time in the NFL where everybody was looking for these 6'3", 220-pound monster wide receivers that could just go up and make all the plays. I think now we're starting to understand that actually the guys you want to be finding are the guys that just get open. And, you know, maybe they won't win a jump ball 40 yards down the field all the time, but if they're open, it doesn't matter. So
sometimes you've got simple. You go back to the simplicity. Separation is king. Getting open is king.
So you've got Tyler Lockett, right, who is smaller than me. Tyler Lockett is 5'10", 182. Now, okay, he's got me by a few pounds, but I've got an inch in height over him, so we're good, right?
He's got you
by basically my size.
Skill.
Basically my size, right? That is not the typical NFL wide receiver profile. And you would expect that he can't, you know, go up and make all these plays. But he's open so much of the time that he doesn't need to go and win a jump ball against a 6'2" cornerback because he's beaten him for 2 yards of separation off the line of scrimmage. So the Seahawks have got Tyler Lockett. You've got Doug Baldwin, who has one of the two best releases off the line in the NFL. I would say Adam Thielen has the other one. Those two guys win right away. So consequently, they're wide open for Russell Wilson regularly. And I think it really is setting the template. It's what we said with that Panthers offense for years. Is that it's taken them
three, four
years to figure out that if we just get a guy that gets open, it's actually better than if we just get huge people or guys with giant catch radiuses or whatever.
It sounds so simple. But because we chart open throws versus tight window throws, Russell Wilson, number 4 passer rating in the NFL on open throws at 125, and PFF grades right up there as well. He's number 5 on open throws. So it sounds simple, just get open, but Tyler Lockett does it, Doug Baldwin does it, David Moore's done it. So they've done a pretty good job with the Seattle passing.
The other thing is these guys that excel through being shifty and quick and winning at the line, if there is a weakness of those longer, stronger, physical cornerbacks like Byron Jones, it's dealing with people like that. Like the Richard Sherman and Brandon Browner back in the original Legion of Boom days,
right.
They struggled the most going up against smaller, shiftier receivers. Like, those are the guys that gave them the biggest problems. So that'll be a fascinating matchup to watch, is how Byron Jones does against those guys if he can't get hands on them immediately at the line, if he's going to be struggling for living with them in terms of quickness.
So the Seattle passing attack against this Dallas back seven plus DeMarcus Lawrence rushing the passer, big matchup. The Seattle run game, as much as we like to dismiss run games because they're so dedicated to it, Chris Carson is running extremely well. He's graded well for us because the offensive line has been okay, not great. He's creating a ton of yards after contact. He's running really hard every time. It does feel like every guy they could put up there in Seattle is just running hard. They just run with some tenacity. So I'm going to love watching them against Jalen Smith and Leighton Vander Esch. You said they fly around the field. They make a ton of plays. Leighton Vander Esch, top five in the NFL on defensive stops. Jalen Smith has that burst back. So as much as we like to talk about the passing game, I'm going to be watching the run game and watching these linebackers fill in against these Seattle running backs.
These two teams are placed next to each other in terms of overall PFF grade, as a team. So 87.0 for the Seahawks and 86.9 for the
pretty close.
Ranks? For Dallas.
Eighth and
ninth. They're middle of the pack.
Okay,
strangely,
a little bit lower.
But they're neck and neck, right? They're separated by 0.1 of a grading point.
All right, let's go to the other side of the ball. You've got Dak Prescott and the Dallas Cowboys. You've got Zeke Elliott, Amari Cooper. It looks like the Cowboys might have their triplets back. They love having triplets at all times. That's what they do. That's how they build it in Dallas. You got to have the triplets against the Seattle defense, which, you know, has played some really good games at home, and then they've been a little touch and go on the road. They're more the Seattle's team has always been interesting for a few years because they're more likely, like Russell Wilson's great at home, but they're more likely to play a defensive struggle at home, I think, and then on the road they get into these shootout situations. Not all the time, but you see that a little bit.
Yeah, I think
not
that's,
like in the playoffs when they won 10-9 against Minnesota, but
yeah, no, I think that's true. Particularly, you know, you go on the road to Dallas in a dome, so it's not like they're going to be dealing with adverse conditions that's going to slow them down. They're a fascinating team because they are capable of doing both, right? They're capable of being this run-first offense that just grinds teams down, but they're also capable of abandoning that entirely, putting the ball on Russell Wilson's hands and letting him make crazy things happen.
Right.
A bit like Deshaun Watson. He's well capable of doing that. It's going to be a case of how successful that is going up against this Dallas defense, though.
I think we're going to learn early. So there's two things to look at. I think going back to the Seattle offense, because you mentioned Russell Wilson, but we've talked about the games where he's pressured over 40-45% of the time, disastrous things happen, as well as Russell Wilson plays under pressure.
Yeah.
Disastrous things happen. Also, Russell Wilson, you could usually tell early if he has it or not. And we were just talking about this in the office the other day about the volatility of quarterbacks at a game level. Russell Wilson has three or four games a year where he's just really not that good. And then three or four games where you're like, this is the best quarterback in the NFL. Top one, top two quarterback in the NFL. You might be able to tell early if Russell Wilson's on or not. But if Dallas makes him feel uncomfortable early, I think Seattle could be in trouble. Sorry, go back into the Dallas offense. Dak Prescott has not played great. He's had some. He was really good last Sunday against the Giants. That's a whole different animal. Why was he playing? That whole discussion. But overall, he's the guy that's kind of put up some better stats than the grades would show over the last few weeks.
Yeah, I'm kind of fascinated. So we talked about Nuke Hopkins having this one freaky statistic, the drop rate. His probably got the best hands in the league because he just doesn't drop passes anymore. Bobby Wagner is the defensive equivalent. Bobby Wagner doesn't miss tackles.
Yeah, it's really
almost
incredible.
Ever. So he has four missed tackles over the past two seasons. Now,
that's a game for some linebackers.
It is a game for some linebackers, and it's a good number in and of itself for a season. Like, if a linebacker missed four tackles on the season, it would be a pretty good year. But it's even better than that because the three missed tackles that he missed a year ago all came in the final couple of weeks of the season where he was playing through a busted shoulder. So he went basically the entire year without missing a tackle, then was forced to play hurt for a couple of weeks and missed three, I think, in the final three games with an injured shoulder. Then this year, he didn't miss a single tackle until week 16 against the Chiefs.
It's
so
crazy.
Basically, you're talking about a guy who has one missed tackle while playing healthy over 2 years, which is completely absurd number.
He's our highest graded linebacker. Number like both, one in coverage, number two against the run.
Both the Dallas linebackers, who have played fantastically, I think are in double digits for missed tackles.
Yeah.
And they're not, you know, this. So Luke Kuechly is at 9. Luke Kuechly is
and he's one of the
machine.
Best tacklers in
yeah,
the NFL.
Jalen Smith is at 12. Van Der Esch is at 13. So most linebackers are into double digits. Wagner's missed one.
Wagner earned first team All-Pro for us at PFF. Only one missed tackle on 138 attempts this year. As I mentioned, number one in coverage, number two run defense, also has 7 pass breakups, has not allowed a touchdown in coverage either.
Joe Schobert, who graded well, missed 24 tackles this season.
24?
Yeah.
Love Joe. Got to cut down on those. Cut down on a few of those, think where the grade goes. Let's discuss Amari Cooper really quick because, you know, he was written off pretty much in Oakland. I think people laughed at this trade, right?
Yeah.
They laughed at the Amari Cooper trade.
Yeah, they laughed at the first round pick, right?
Yeah. I don't think that was crazy because I know you have to pay him, so you're paying a first rounder, but he's still a first round caliber wide receiver.
Well, now, apparently. But I think the point was, I don't know that you could have guaranteed that from at the point they traded him, right? It's not like, you know, Derek Carr has had his struggles, but it's not like he's a disaster at quarterback. You're not looking at this guy and saying he's 100% held back by the fact that he has no quarterback throwing him the ball. Like he's
a first round is rich because you're assuming he's going to be in the open market soon.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Either way, is this a number one wide receiver since coming over?
Yes.
Well, I'm going to read some numbers to you and you can say yes.
Fine. Okay.
He's 10th in targets with 72. He's averaged 2.15 yards per route. That's an excellent number. He's had a passer rating of 121.5 when targeted and a PFF grade of 82.5. Now, is that a number one wide receiver?
Yes. Yes, okay. It is, Steve.
So they've got a number one wide receiver. And they've got Zeke Elliott in the backfield. So as much as we talk about the pass games and, you know, Cooper's going to be a key here and he needs to get open for Dak. He's top 10 in the NFL. I just tweeted it yesterday. Top 10 in the NFL in targets when open against single coverage. You got all those parameters?
Yeah.
Because we track, is it single coverage? Is it hole in zone? I think this is a telling stat because it's all your best route runners at the top. It's Adam Thielen. It's Keenan Allen. Devontae Adams. Cooper's at the top. So he can beat man coverage. But now you've got two teams that want to run the ball. Dallas wants to run the ball with Zeke. Seattle wants to run the ball. So maybe it's not going to be a shootout. Maybe that's actually going to condense the game a little bit.
Yeah, the yards per route run stat, I think, is a key one for Cooper. There's 15 guys in the league this year over 2. So anything over 2 is a very good number. The league leader is Julio Jones, which is usually the case, at 2.9. But the second guy,
now.
Yeah, the second guy is Michael Thomas at 2.66. So, you know, Cooper's right up there amongst the very elite guys. And these top guys are exactly who you would think they would be. It's Julio Jones, Michael Thomas, T.Y. Hilton, Tyreek Hill, Nuke Hopkins, Keenan Allen. It's, you know, it's the cream of the wide receiver group up there in terms of production. So Cooper has been up with that group since he moved over to Dallas.
All right. So I love the matchup overall. Dallas has the weapons, I think, now, or a weapon, to maybe get into the shootout situation if they need to. But I'm taking Seattle because, even though both teams, I think there's going to be a feel-out process. They're all going to try to establish the run. At some point, they unleash the quarterbacks. We get into more of a shootout situation. And I like Russell. I'm taking both road teams here on Saturday. That's crazy. I like Russell Wilson in the shootout situation. He's got the highest percentage of big-time throws in the NFL this week. I think that's what he does, big-time throws.
I am going to go with Dallas because they're at home, and therefore that will win them the game. But do you want to know something that could be a pretty significant momentum swing within the game?
What's that?
Fumbles, right? Zeke Elliott has 6 fumbles on his carries this season, which is double any other running back in the NFL. Dak Prescott has 4 fumbles rushing this season, which is...
He's got way more just in the pocket, though.
Right. Plus, we've charged him for the most sacks of anybody, which leads to strip sacks, which leads to fumbles in the passing game. So this is a team that will put the ball on the ground a lot. Just those two, just on running plays, 10 fumbles. You know how many they've lost?
I don't know. That's luck, though.
Right.
3?
2.
2. Yeah, that's
so
luck.
At the moment, they've only lost 20% of the balls they put on the ground. If that swings back to the Seahawks within this game, I mean, that could be huge.
Let me add to it because I'm looking at Dak's passing numbers. He has a 74.6 overall PFF grade. Okay, where does that rank overall? 74.6 is only 19th in the NFL, right behind Marcus Mariota, right ahead of Nick Foles and Derek Carr. The Carr family going to tweet me about that one, too. So he's 19th. Is that what I said? If you sort by fumble grade, which essentially says, look, if you get strip sack in the motion and it's really on the blocking, we're not really going to dock you for that. But when you have a bad ball security and you're trying to scramble and you fumble and you see a guy's coming after you and you still try to get rid of it and you fumble and it's a really bad decision, we're going to give you a really bad grade. So the fumble grade sorts through that. Third worst fumble grade in the NFL is Dak Prescott, 28.8. So again, if you guys have PFF Elite, if you guys are using PFF numbers and you say, well, Dak has a 96.9 passer rating, that's very good, it's well above average, why is his grade only a 74.6? Sometimes you go to the fumble grade and you're like, all right, that's tying it together. So the worst fumble grade in the NFL is Cody Kessler, then Lamar Jackson, who we'll talk about in a minute, then Dak Prescott, 28.8. So something to keep an eye on.
Right. So I'm just saying there's not an insignificant chance that the Dallas Cowboys put the ball on the ground, and so far they've been really lucky when that's happened.
Yeah, Dak, the sack thing has been huge, too. Right. He's been doing the spin-out move where he's, you know, losing yardage and stuff. So keep an eye on Dak and his pocket presence in this one. I'm taking Seattle. You're taking Dallas. Let's get to Sunday's action now. Yeah, you're right. We don't go quickly through this at all.
No.
It's all right. We're just trying to bring some depth to everybody. We're halfway home, Sam.
Yeah.
Halfway home. Los Angeles Chargers traveling to the Baltimore Ravens. The poor Chargers have to play at 10 a.m. in a cross-country battle. That is significant.
That's not, I mean, 10 a.m. It's not that early.
After traveling across the country?
Well, travel across the country, you know, early.
It's a significant
aspect.
For
a while.
So on
like
paper.
It's not like they're playing at 6 in the morning. Like, 10 a.m. is plenty of time to get your ass up, have breakfast, chill for a bit, and get on the field.
Okay. Anyway, we're 2 weeks removed from Baltimore crushing the Chargers on the road. And we know how much home and road really matters in the NFL. It's about a 6-point swing, you know, when you switch venues, right? Because it's 3 points for the home team, yeah, in Vegas terms. So the fact that the Ravens just recently went to Los Angeles, Philip Rivers had a passer rating of 51.7 in that game. That was the lowest he's had all season. Baltimore's defense is just playing really good football right now, even though Baker Mayfield put some points on the board there. He did have 3 picks, but he put some points on the board against them. This looks like, I mean, this should be the Ravens at home, right?
Well, I think it comes down to two things. One, how much pressure the Ravens are going to get on Philip Rivers this time, because that really was the thing that decided the game last time. They got an absolute
55%
ton of pressure
of dropbacks,
which meant that the Chargers scored 10 points. The other aspect is the Chargers are one of a few teams now that have had a shot at Lamar Jackson twice, or will have had a shot at Lamar Jackson twice.
Yeah.
And I've been making the point to some pushback on social media that Lamar Jackson right now is not winning games because he's very good. He's winning games because he is presenting a novel offense and something different that teams are not used to defending. And this is not like
it's because you just can't get over, because you live in black and white terms of good and bad.
This is not exactly a controversial statement. It's not like it's the first time this has ever happened, right? When a new quarterback comes along that is stylistically different from other quarterbacks, they typically have a lot more success than they should right away, right? Or than their play level dictates. Then the NFL figures out how to defend them, and suddenly those guys start playing worse. And we talk about sophomore slumps and what happened to X and why is Tim Tebow playing baseball instead of football right now? Like,
so Lamar's
going to
be playing baseball in a few years.
That's not what I'm saying.
I know.
What I'm saying is that Tim Tebow came along, won a lot of games because he presented something completely different to NFL defenses, and it took them a while to figure out how to deal with that. Once they did, it turns out Tim Tebow's not a very good player and he couldn't make it in the NFL. What we've been saying all along is that Lamar Jackson is going to survive or fail based on how good the passing part of his game is, which right now is his weakness.
It absolutely is. It's by far, he's definitely a below average passer.
Right.
So let's go back. We've said this a million times. Let's go back. In our pre-draft analysis on Lamar, I think is spot on right now, right? You put him in a run heavy scheme with designed runs. He's exceptional. He's an incredible runner of the football. He has 130 designed runs. That's the most ever. It's the most we've tracked since 2006. It's definitely the most ever since like the 40s, right? That's it. 130, 562 yards on design runs, 45 first downs or touchdowns. He does have 12 fumbles. We'll talk about that in a minute. Exceptional runner. He's a below-average passer from an accuracy standpoint, yet he's also capable of doing NFL things in the pocket. He surveys the field. He dropped in that beautiful pass to Mark Andrews a couple of weeks ago against the Chargers. He can make big-time throws, but he's going to miss more than everyone else in the NFL.
Yeah.
That's where he is right now.
So, yeah. So the fact that he's capable of making those big-time throws is a big mitigating factor in his favor in terms of the passing. Yes, he's averaging like 150 yards passing a game, which is a terrible number in today's NFL, even offset with the rushing success. But he's capable of making those big throws. And honestly, one of those big throws was the difference in the game the first time they played. He hit, was it Mark Andrews down
the
middle on a perfect play? And that honestly was the difference between the two teams on that day. So he's capable of being the difference from a passing point of view, but most of the time he's missing too many of those plays. But I think it is critical. The Chargers are the first team that's going to get two cracks at Lamar Jackson, right?
Yeah.
And the point I've been making is that eventually teams figure out how to defend these guys that present a unique offense to a defense. And obviously, the more times you see it, the more opportunity you have to figure out how to stop it. Now, it's not like it was a runaway success the first time these two teams played. The Ravens scored 22 points overall, and really that one play was the difference. One big play in that game, a catch and run to Mark Andrews over the middle, was basically
right.
That was the majority of the output. He passed for 204 yards on 12 completions, and one of them was, 60-something yards to Mark Andrews. So that's a big thing. It's not like this was at 68 yards was that play. It's not like this was a runaway success the first time around, and the Chargers have had a look at it already. So I think the two things are, will the Ravens get that level of pressure on Phillip Rivers again, and therefore will the Chargers be kept to 10 points again, and will the Chargers defense have figured out Lamar Jackson?
No, I think it's fair. I think it's a fair point. Lamar Jackson, because people have cited completion percentage for Lamar as well. He's at 58.2. That's 36th in the NFL right now. Yes, it's above Sam Darnold, Josh Rosen, and Josh Allen, by the way, the other rookies. I think my issue...
Who have been bad.
Yes, they have not played well at
right.
all.
Largely.
What I'm saying about Lamar, though, and what we said in our pre-draft analysis as well, he's below those guys in ball location accuracy, below Josh Allen as well. He's worst in the NFL, as in... And we saw it in the Chargers game, too. He's got a wide-open receiver, and he puts it on his kneecaps for a completion. Right? So because of Lamar's running ability and the fact that defenses have to account for him and they run more play action, he will have more open throws.
Pretty much.
That's how you get to the higher completion percentage. So let me finish my thoughts, Sam. I got this.
No matter what way you slice it, Lamar Jackson is an inaccurate quarterback at a macro level. That should not be a controversial statement. And if we can't make it without getting into an argument, we probably can't talk.
Well, this is where you've had issues with, Panthers fans.
Right. So Lamar Jackson, he is it the lowest completion percentage in the NFL, just raw completion percentage, or the second lowest, did you
Lamar?
Say? Yeah.
He's second lowest in adjusted completion percentage. He's lowest in our accuracy.
So lowest in accuracy percentage, one of the lowest in straight
completion percentage.
And 37th in adjusted completion percentage. So no matter what way you slice it, he is a fundamentally inaccurate quarterback that is capable of making spectacularly accurate passes.
That's the key, right?
And that, I think, differentiates him from some of these other fundamentally inaccurate quarterbacks we've seen over the years. Guys that just aren't accurate enough to play, we're not really capable of those spectacular plays. But Lamar is, and that's what makes him a really intriguing guy as a passer, is that I don't think what we get now is what he is going forward, necessarily. He can make spectacular plays. He does a lot of quarterback things in terms of going through reads, finding the right guy, and identifying where to put the ball. He just misses too many throws. But the question is, can he get good enough at the first two parts of that to offset the last part? Can you make enough good plays, and can you be good enough in terms of identifying where to go with the ball that it doesn't matter that you will miss more throws than other people when you add in the fact that you can then be a rushing threat as well? I don't know the answer to that. I think that's what determines whether he'll succeed or fail. But right now, my basic point is he's a spectacular runner, spectacular athlete, is winning largely because he's presenting a novel offense to NFL defenses.
But also, the one piece that you're missing here, he's very good at running this offense.
Of course.
He's very good at running.
Right.
All right. And this is where you're arguing with people, because you said he's not good. And
he
at an overall level, he's not a good quarterback. At what he's being asked to do, running the football, he's very good at it.
Other than fumbling.
And so this is where the PFF grade's not going to match up, and this is what I was going to come back down to. This game comes down to turnovers. And I know that's the generic. Nobody tuned into PFF to hear this game comes down to turnovers, but let me do it from a PFF standpoint. He has 9 turnover-worthy plays against 6 big-time throws this year.
Yeah.
So as much as we say he can sit there and make big-time throws, capable of it, yes. Does he do it at a high level? No.
6, which, by the way, didn't Ryan Fitzpatrick have 6 in a game, or was it 5 in a game?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got not many.
So that's not great.
He doesn't have many. But 9 turnover-worthy throws, okay, plus 12 fumbles. Some of the fumbles on him, some of them not, but the fact that he's got the second lowest fumble grade, again, yeah, without even looking at the specifics on the fumbles, I know that we've downgraded him heavily mm-hmm. for those fumbles, a lot of them coming from the rushing attack. So while he's picked up 500-something yards, so let me ask you this. View it like this. If you were, he's got 560 rushing yards. He's probably opened up a big, you know, some big holes for Gus Edwards. Let's pretend that Lamar is accountable for 1,000 rushing yards right now. Is that worth 12 fumbles? Let's call it 10 fumbles. You know, if you were gonna have 1,000 passing yards, right? If I told you you're gonna have 1,000 passing yards over 7 games, but you're gonna have 10 turnover worthy plays to get those,
yeah,
right? That's a high number. Yes. That's a risky number. Now those passes could get dropped as intercept. They could be intercepted. They could be dropped interceptions. His fumbles could be recovered by the Ravens. They could be, but that's risky, and that's where we are with this whole thing. The rushing is difficult to stop. Gus Edwards has been exceptional. It's a completely different offense. The fumbles are an issue. The turnover-worthy throws are an issue. He does have issues seeing underneath linebackers. Chargers play a lot of zone-heavy scheme. That's, I think, what's going to happen with this Ravens offense. I think that's going to be the key.
Yeah. I mean, when you net everything out, they've obviously massively increased the amount they're rushing with Lamar Jackson at quarterback. They've catapulted that. You know, they're averaging 200-plus yards a game on the ground compared to like 100 when it was Joe Flacco at quarterback.
Right.
So they basically doubled their rushing output. On the other hand, they're averaging like 150 passing yards when he's the quarterback. So it's not like a giant output overall. Like, it's gone up. I think they're averaging 19 yards more of total offense per game with Lamar in than they are Joe Flacco. So the offense has basically got the same output. It's just a completely different style.
Let's discuss the Baltimore defense a little bit, because our numbers have them 9th or 10th in the NFL just from a pure grading standpoint. Our EPA numbers have them in the top 5. They are one of the best defenses in the league, there's no doubt. And it still comes back to, are they capable? Are they capable in a one-game setting? And the way they stop the run up front, the way they've rushed the passer in recent weeks, you've got Terrell Suggs still going.
Yeah.
You have Za'Darius Smith leading the team with 60 pressures, and he really killed the Chargers the last time around. He's an edge that essentially, he's a big edge that they've started to move inside. Matthew Judon has 42. The big question mark coming into the season was Baltimore's ability to rush the passer, because they've got a pretty nice little secondary. They have 3 guys with over 40 pressures. That's very significant.
It is. And it really comes down to how much they're going to get pressure on Phillip Rivers, because those guys were destroyed, the Chargers' offensive line, the first time they played. And it hasn't gotten better since. I mean, right, they didn't have to pass much against the Denver Broncos, but Rivers was under pressure 11 plays and only had 13 without pressure. So they still had a pretty good day against the Chargers' offensive line. I said before, they kind of reminded me a little bit of the Minnesota Vikings in terms of a team whose offensive line woes is going to come back to haunt them at the worst time, like in the playoffs, where you go up against the best defensive fronts, and they're just not good enough to keep their head above water in those games. And, you know, Phillip Rivers, as spectacular as he's played this year, again, you reach that point where it's just critical mass, and he can't play given that volume of pressure. The Ravens were ahead of that level the last time they played, and I don't know what the Chargers could do between then and now to change that.
And Rivers has struggled a little bit down the stretch. Definitely statistically, the grades haven't been as bad as the stats have shown, but he's got multiple interceptions in a couple games now, 3 straight games, 6 interceptions out of his 12 over the last 3 weeks. Not all on him, but we have seen a few more of those YOLO balls, you know, just chuck it up. And those were the games that we said Phillip Rivers hasn't had yet. He has been remarkably consistent. His lowest game grade was week 11 against Denver at home, 64.6. His lowest game grade at 64 is really good. and of course he's got a bunch in the 80s and 90s, does he revert back to, you know, there's always one or two games a year where he's three picks, four picks that are on him that are just terrible. He has that in him, you know, potentially too, especially when under pressure.
That's the thing. I think he might, but if he does, it's going to be entirely down to the volume of pressure that comes on him. Like his passer rating under pressure this season was absurd for a lot of the year.
Yeah.
He was up, that's come down almost 20 points over the past few weeks. Again, just because we've reached this level, this threshold mark, which beyond which there is no coming back from. You can't play in the face of that level of pressure. And I just, for the Chargers, I think this game almost comes down to what have they figured out in terms of doing since that happened to stop that happening again
on both sides of the ball.
Yeah,
what have they figured out?
But I think even if they do exactly the same job against Lamar as they did last time,
true.
I think they've got a shot if they figured out a way to take that pressure rating down 15%. If they haven't, they just can't win. I mean, literally, they can't win this game unless they figured out a way of mitigating that.
Hunter Henry, key to the game.
Right.
Yeah. Finally. He's going to play some snaps.
He is.
He's going to play a little bit. Hunter Henry, perhaps the key to the game.
I mean, Stephen A. Smith had that weeks ago.
He did. We're way behind. In our official picks, I think I took the Chargers.
Okay.
I don't feel great about it. But I took the Chargers. Where'd you go with it?
Ravens.
You're taking the Ravens.
Yep.
The Lamar train. All right.
One left.
Even though you're a hater. One left. We're flying through this thing.
Oh, yeah.
Philadelphia Eagles fighting Nick Foles against the Chicago Bears. This is where Bears fans tune in and love us on YouTube and on the podcast. You know, I haven't checked our breakdown yet, but I'm assuming we still have all of our Chicago listeners.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Still our number two city.
I have to check. Probably not. The best defense in the league, the Chicago Bears, taking on Nick Foles. If Nick Foles is going to pull this one off again, he's got to go through the best defense in the league.
Yeah.
And the Bears.
Yeah. The Foles thing is fascinating because, well, one, the prospect that he could actually repeat this ridiculous run that he had that went from being essentially an afterthought comedy backup quarterback to actually he just had probably the two greatest postseason games ever and won a Super Bowl. The idea that he could potentially repeat that is insane. The idea they're even in the postseason, given what needed to happen for them to make it, is pretty crazy.
What if he goes on a four-game stretch here?
Right. But what's really fascinating is that he hasn't come close to the level he played at in the NFC Championship game or the Super Bowl. Those two games were like way in the 90s. They were basically as good as you're going to play. And so far, he's been pretty good, but he's been grading in the 70s. Like,
right.
Consistently in the 70s, which is actually remarkable for Nick Foles, to whom consistency is not a friend. But it's because we've talked before about how you can get anything out of Nick Foles from amazing to terrible, and you don't really know where it's going to land. At the moment, it's landed pretty consistently just north of average into reasonably good territory, which means that there's a ton of extra room to get better. Like, we could see this Nick Foles spectacular play come again, but obviously there's the looming specter of we could get this train wreck.
So let's do it from a number standpoint, okay? And we mentioned this a couple weeks ago, but Nick Foles playing really well under pressure. 90.6 passer rating under pressure so far this year. In his limited sample, that's number one in the NFL, just ahead of Deshaun Watson and ahead of Dak Prescott, guys that are playing this weekend. And again, if you guys have been listening to us, you know, hey, that fluctuates, right? That's volatile. Here's the on-field reason why it's volatile and why it fluctuates. I call it the Josh McCown factor.
Okay.
The Josh McCown obliviousness, the obliviousness quotient is what I like to say, in the pocket. Josh McCown obliviousness quotient. In 2013, Josh McCown steps in there for the Bears, and he was making ridiculous throws in the pocket under pressure for the Bears. The Bucs go and sign him that offseason. They're like, oh, Josh McCown, he's going to be our guy. And he went from the best quarterback or one of the best under pressure to the worst. And he was doing the same thing. So the same throw where you're like, man, great job. Stood, you know, looked down the barrel and made this great throw. And he took a hit and he dropped a dime in there. You're like, hey, great throw. It's not because he was tough or whatever. He just didn't feel where the pressure was coming from. And every now and again, it works. And then you do the same exact thing. And you're like, how did you not feel that pressure? And you make the same throw, and this time you're just a little off, and it's intercepted. That's why pressure fluctuates. It's because you sit there, and there are certain guys who just don't feel pressure that well, and it works for them on some throws, and it works completely against them on other throws, and the result is essentially, you know, random. That is Nick Foles so far this year.
Yeah.
If you look at some of the throws he's made, especially like in the fourth quarter, you're like, how did he get that ball down the field to Alshon Jeffrey? How did he do that? And the results have been, you know, absolutely fantastic. 66% of he's completing 66% of his passes under pressure. And a lot of them are down the field. That's crazy talk.
Yeah, and his downfield passing has been really impressive. He's got a pass rating of 103 on deep passes down the field. The one thing I think that he is really good at is being prepared to heave the ball down the field, knowing he is about to get murdered by somebody running right at him at full tilt.
Oh, he is.
To the point where
some of those plays have been really good.
To the point where he did it against the Rams, and you're like, I mean, that's Aaron Donald. If there's one guy that you might want to go, you know what, it's not worth it, I'm bailing on this one, it's Aaron Donald.
Well, yeah, so I mean so that's where he's really good, and he's got some strength and he's got some arm strength to get the ball down the field. But I think this game comes down to, on this side of the ball at least, when he's pressured, when Khalil Mack gets there, he's got 69 pressures, he's healthy. When Akeem Hicks gets there, when those guys get pressure, does he stand in the face of it and does the throw get to his receiver? Or does the throw land in Roquan Smith's hands? Or does it land in Eddie Jackson's hands? Does it land in the defense's hands?
I mean, I think that's the thing here is that the Eagles' offensive line, I think, might hold their own against Chicago's defensive front. As much as you've got Akeem Hicks, who wrecked the Vikings, you've got Khalil Mack, who can wreck anybody. The Eagles' O-line is still pretty good and might, I think, do a decent job. The problem is that over the past few weeks, Foles has been heaving these balls to Alshon Jeffrey, has been wide open or dominating smaller guys. The Bears actually have some legit coverage on the back end. So,
by the way, I know Eddie Jackson's banged up and potentially might not play.
Right. So this isn't going to be, you know, free passes down the field the way it has been necessarily over the past few weeks. They're going to actually have to beat some relatively impressive coverage to get those opportunities. And if you're throwing it downfield just into a contested situation, I think they're going to be more contested or more fiercely contested than they have been in recent times. That could be the problem that derails this Philadelphia offense.
So, yeah, they're banking on some Foles magic. Alshon Jeffrey's been fantastic for him down the stretch. Anything else on this Bears defense? I mean, Akeem Hicks, it's funny. Every time we put up an all-pro team, you know, everybody gets in there with their favorite player, and you know, this guy was snubbed. We've seen some Akeem Hicks snub talk, and it's like, well, you have Aaron Donald and Fletcher Cox, and we'll talk about Fletcher Cox in a minute. I mean, those guys are the clear top two guys, but Akeem Hicks and Chris Jones from the Chiefs, I mean, they're in that next tier of just awesome this year, so they deserve credit.
I mean, Akeem Hicks has been a better player than a lot of all-pro players, just not at his position.
Yes.
His problem
is
there's just two better guys.
Yeah, no, that's fair. So Akeem Hicks, exceptional year for him. We know Khalil Mack coming off the edge. And, you know, as we look back at the 2018 season, our free agent analysis on the Bears was, you know, they really should just try to bring the secondary back, right? Prince Amukamara.
Yeah.
Fuller. You know, Adrian Amos back there. I mean, we were like, hey, if you just bring the band back together, they'll be pretty good. And that's essentially what's happened.
Yeah. This is the only game of the weekend that isn't a rematch of some kind over this season.
Interesting.
That's a shame. That would have been a nice symmetry.
It would have been.
Every game is a rematch.
It would have been. But I do have to say, I love a good, you know,
rematch.
Cold weather playoff game in Chicago.
Yeah?
I do love that.
You know, I hope it snows.
I hope it snows, too.
I always like snow games.
Foles in the snow.
Anybody like, in the snow. Snow games are quality. I'm not going to listen to anybody who whinges about the impact it has on the football. Snow games are just better, period.
All right, I'm with you.
The end.
All right, let's go to the other side of the ball. The Eagles' defensive line, we have some numbers.
Still the best in the NFL.
By far.
Yeah.
As far as getting
they have
goes.
37 more total pressures than any other team in the league. They have the best win percentage, the best pressure rate, the best pass rushing productivity score. They are the best pass rushing unit in the NFL, despite Brandon Graham only getting 5 sacks on the year.
Why are you going to bring that up?
Because you lost the bet.
It's
and
like
I
fifth
did.
In total pressures or something, too.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. My favorite was what happened when the chips were down. You know,
last week.
The game is on the line. Steve needs Brandon Graham to actually convert some of these pressures into sacks. And over the last 2 weeks, Brandon Graham got, 14, 15, 17 total pressures and 0 sacks.
He is actually, so he has one more pressure than Khalil Mack. Granted, he's done it on a few more rushes, but the point is he's got 70 pressures.
Yeah.
Only five of which are sacks.
Right.
That is one of the lowest conversion rates you'll ever see, which is why I bet that he would have five more sacks. I bet a lunch.
You did. The problem is he's always like that, and he probably should have seen that coming.
Except last year. He bucked the
right.
trend in
2000, year.
And then they win the Super Bowl.
How many total pressures did you say he had?
70. Five divided by 70.
Yeah, so actually, that is pretty much his career baseline. It's seven. It's a conversion rate of 7.1%. And I think when I ran this before last season, his kind of baseline for his career was like 8%. So it's slightly worse in his baseline.
In his baseline is way below the average of like,
oh yeah, his baseline is like half of the average. 15
is it 15
for edge rushes,
which is why I was banking on, you know, there's no way this is that big of a trend with him. I'm banking on him reverting back to the average.
But my point was that's his career baseline. That's probably where he's going to end up, and it turns out not only did he end up around there, he ended up the other side of it.
Well, because he's getting
good work, Brandon.
That allows guys like Michael Bennett to get sacks, Fletcher Cox to get sacks. That's what's happening. So the Eagles,
Fletcher Cox is number two in the NFL in total pressures. If it wasn't for Aaron Donald again, that would be insane. Interior guys do not get pressure at the same rate as edge guys.
He has 17 more pressures than the next closest guy. So it's Aaron Donald with 106, Fletcher Cox with 95. They're both interior players. This number is supposed to be led by edge defenders. The first edge defender is Dee Ford with 78 and J.J. Watt with 75.
Right. This is a 310-pound guy getting what should be a league-leading number of total pressures. Only Aaron Donald is there as well.
Yep. So Fletcher Cox, he's got the second highest grade among all defensive linemen. Of course, he's 3 points below Aaron Donald, but pretty significant. 92.6 grade for Fletcher Cox. By the way, Akeem Hicks, 91.7, our number four graded defensive interior player. And Hicks has 51 total pressures. So it's going to be this Eagles defensive line. Chicago offensive line's done a good job, and the story we've mentioned all year is that the scheme in Chicago has been fantastic. Mitch Trubisky's overall stats have been pretty good. He's running the ball extremely well. We trash Trubisky. That's all we do. But most importantly, he is playing well over these last few weeks, and he's throwing the ball much better and taking care of it much better.
Yeah, although every single one of these games seems to come with at least one clanking play that, you know, torpedoes his grade. So it's like we would be grading him really well, only he keeps making one play a game that's like, oh, stop it.
Bad interception, fumble.
Yeah, and so many times they don't show up in the box score. So it's like a negated terrible interception.
But it does go back to what we said earlier in the year. If he does start playing better and making throws beyond the sticks, you know, and moving the chains and all these different things that he's doing outside of the scheme, it makes them very dangerous because they've got Tariq Cohen, who has been as valuable as any running back in the NFL. It's pretty much him and Saquon Barkley from just a pure value standpoint. They move them all over the place. You have Allen Robinson, who can make those contested catches. You have Trey Burton. Again, our preseason analysis, offseason analysis, is all of these weapons merging together could potentially lead to a pretty good offense, and that's what we've had in Chicago.
Yeah, they're still one of the highest teams in the NFL in terms of RPO usage, those run-pass options. So this is one of the hardest offenses in the National Football League to defend because they show you everything.
Right.
And there's so much to have to deal with. They can run the ball up the middle with Jordan Howard the way they did with the Vikings, just grind them out. They can hit Tariq Cohen on the edge. They can pass the ball to Tariq Cohen, give you matchup problems with him. You have to cover a legit number one in Allen Robinson. You have to deal with these RPOs, the fact that they show you three different things to have to defend at any one time. This is just a really hard offensive system to shut down because you have to cover so many different things all at once, and there aren't that many defenses that can do that.
Yeah, so I think what I'm looking at here, though, is the way Trubisky plays under pressure, because a lot of times when he faces pressure, I feel like a lot of quarterbacks are doing this. Deshaun Watson does it sometimes. Russell Wilson does it sometimes. You're taught not to drop your eyes, right?
Yeah.
But there's a lot of quarterbacks who are playing right now, and Trubisky does this. He drops his eyes, and he says, okay, let me navigate the rush first. I'm going to navigate the rush first, get out of the pocket. And then when he gets out of the pocket, sometimes he's looking to throw. He's probably not looking to throw as much as a Russell Wilson or a Deshaun Watson, but he'll run, and he's got 29 first downs picked up with his legs. He's third in the league with 421 yards as a scrambler behind Josh Allen and Deshaun Watson. So I'm curious to see is when he faces pressure, is he going to try to navigate the pocket, get outside, or is he going to make throws in the face of pressure, because his PFF grade drops about 25 points as a passer when he's facing pressure.
Yeah, how much pressure the Eagles' defensive front can actually get on him is a big thing, and then how well their coverage holds up on the back end is, I think, the thing that's been defining their entire season. Is everybody got hurt, and they were forced way deep into the bench, and guys that had no business starting were being put out there and getting just destroyed. And it was going extremely ugly. So two things have happened. One, the guys that were hurt have started to come back and actually obviously improve the talent level. Two, the guys that were thrown into the fire have started to be tempered a little bit. Those guys have actually been, forged by the fire that they were thrown into and have become better players because of the beating they took.
Right.
This idea that you only get better by playing people better than you. Well, those guys have been playing people better than them all through the season.
Maybe
so they've gotten
worked.
A lot better.
Yeah.
So the Eagles, the coverage is much better now than it was earlier in the season. And I don't know if it's good enough to be able to overcome all these things, but it's at least got to the point where it shouldn't be, eviscerated. And the reason they're losing games immediately right off the bat.
That's fair. So can the Eagles secondary hold up?
Yeah.
Is the big question. Where are you going with this one?
Chicago, home team. I've only taken one road team, I think.
Yeah, I'm taking Chicago as well. Okay. I do think that defense slows down the Foles train too much. They're just too much. They make things difficult. Makes for some really, really great divisional matchups as well if they have to travel. If Chicago wins, they definitely play the Los Angeles Rams. That's the one matchup that's locked in. If the Bears win, that's who they play. If the Eagles win, they definitely play the Saints. But Bears-Rams rematch, but in Los Angeles, could be a really good one. Not that I'm looking ahead. We take it one game at a time here.
Okay.
All right. We're taking the Bears, the Trubisky train. We're riding it. How about that, Bears fans? Riding the Trubisky train at least for one more week. So there you have it. That's it, man. It only took us 4 hours to get through
rapid
fire wild card preview. Of course, if you guys want all these numbers that we have, it's all a part of PFF Elite Premium Stats 2.0, which technically, we don't talk about our job titles here often, Sam, but that's kind of like your baby now. You're kind of in charge of
though it can't be my title, because otherwise my visa expires.
I hope the visa people aren't listening. You didn't change your job. You have the same title, right?
Correct, yes.
You have the same title.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But you've got more on your plate, so to speak.
Yeah. So I'm not allowed to change my job title. Otherwise, I have to change my visa.
They ship you off?
Right, pretty much.
I got to see if we could, if there's one way. If you piss me off, man, I'm going to get you out of here.
Sorry, I'm working on the green card.
I'm going to create a new title for you.
The green card will trump that. Then I can change job title willy-nilly. Weekly, in fact.
I want to promote you to CEO.
Well, you can do
that. Just so you get smoked.
Uh-huh.
So you're out of here.
Once I get the green card, I'm just going to change my title on a weekly basis.
You don't want to be the Sultan of Premium Stats? You can't be that either?
Not yet, no. Green card, then I can get that.
Then you could start changing your title.
Yeah.
All right, so go check out Premium Stats, which is just something else that Sam does right now under his current title so that he doesn't get deported. Thanks, guys, for tuning in. We'll be back again Monday. We'll recap all of the wild card stuff and start looking ahead to divisional round. Everybody enjoy all of the football this weekend. Quick break to tell you guys about NFL Game Pass, the only way that you can replay every game all season long. You can relive all the gutsy calls, crazy catches, wild comebacks, and breakout stars from every game every week. It's all the action, all the football you can handle, all in one place. So every game that we're talking about right now, you guys can rewatch it after the fact. I'm going to be going back, and you guys can too. Go check out Lamar Jackson in week one. Go check out Dak Prescott and what that Cowboys offense actually did. Go check out Kyler Murray and his NFL debut. That's my favorite thing about NFL Game Pass. You can go back and watch at any time. And if you haven't watched a condensed game yet, you have to try it out. It's every play from the game back to back to back, so you can replay an entire NFL game in the fraction of the time it normally takes. It's how I'm able to follow all the MVP candidates, all the breakout stars, and, of course, your waiver wire pickups all season long. To see all the action this season and stay on top of all the big storylines, you need NFL Game Pass. Best of all, you can kick off the 2019 NFL season with a 7-day free trial of NFL Game Pass. Just sign up now at NFL.com/ProFootballFocusNFL.